Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 51 of our live monthly Q&A with Sinton's employment team. I'm David Pritchard, head of marketing here at Sinton's. We have a treat for you this morning. We have three speakers for you, each going to take one of the questions that you've put to us over the course of last month. So you can see in front, you have got Associate Angela Carver, partner Max Winthrop, and making a debut to the employment Q&A is Karina Diaz, who is a trainee solicitor in the department. Same format as usual. We'll just move on to the questions. They are there in front of you. As I said, each of the team is going to answer one of them each. Karina is going to go first. So I'm going to pass straight over. Karina, happy Friday. Good morning and over to you.
Good morning to you, David, and to everyone who's joined us this morning. First question is about reasonable adjustments, and it's on your screens. An employee who's undergoing performance management has said that they believe they have dyslexia and that this is the reason for their poor performance. Are we obliged to fund a diagnostic assessment as a reasonable adjustment? First of all, although the question mentions dyslexia specifically, I should say that anything that you consider in answering the question could also be applied to any other neurodivergent condition, or indeed any condition where you may be considering to fund medical assessment, probably over and above what your normal occupational assessment arrangements are. So where an employer has an employee who is disabled under the Equality Act 2010, they have a duty to make reasonable adjustment where the employee is likely to be placed at a substantial disadvantage in the workplace. In order for this duty to arise, an employee must be disabled and the employer must know or ought reasonably to have known that the employee is disabled. So the first thing to consider in this scenario is the employee actually disabled? Dyslexia and neurodivergence in general in itself is not a disability and can affect individuals in different ways, and they can range from mild to pronounced and serious symptoms. So therefore, not all dyslexic employees will be disabled and protected under the Equality Act. By way of a reminder, disability under the Equality Act is defined as a physical or mental impairment which has a long-term substantial adverse effect on normal day-to-day activities. Long-term, you probably be aware, means one that lasts or is expected to last for 12 months or more. Whether this particular employee in the scenario is deemed to be disabled will depend on the extent to which their symptoms impact on their normal day-to-day activities. And these are things that they normally do regularly every day, may include workplace activities such as communicating or organizing time. The issue is that at this stage, you actually don't know whether the employee is disabled, and you would really need medical opinion to give you more of an idea as to whether they are or not. Failing to do anything and simply proceeding with the performance management at this stage would leave you exposed to disability discrimination claim in the event that this employee ends up being disabled. You have effectively been put on notice of a potential disability, and even in the absence of any formal assessment, you could well be deemed by a tribunal to have had enough information at this stage from discussing the performance issues that you ought to have known that the employee was disabled. As such, you would be expected to take steps to determine whether there is an impairment, which is the reason for the employee's poor performance, and if making any adjustments would be both fair to the individual and materially helpful for them. So let's say this employee is disabled. Then when is the duty to make reasonable adjustments actually triggered? For this to be triggered, there needs to be a substantial disadvantage experienced by the disabled employee in comparison to a non-disabled employee. And in this case, you would be comparing a dyslexic employee to a non-dyslexic employee. A potential disadvantage in the scenario could arise probably in two ways, from the normal application of the usual performance management process, which would constitute a PCP, performance a provision criterion or practice, if the disability is the cause of the underperformance, or it could arise from a lack of supportive steps to help manage the symptoms of dyslexia at work. For example, by not providing aids such as software or training or specialist stationery, which are all very commonly used in relation to dyslexia. And helpfully, the term reasonable is not defined in the Equality Act, but the sort of things a tribunal would take into account would include the type and the size of the employer, cost of the adjustment in the context of the employer's overall financial resources, practicability and effectiveness of an adjustment that you'd put in place, disruption to employer. If you want to look for the detail of this guidance, you will find it in the Employment Code of Practice that you will find on the Equality and Human Rights Commission website. It is also important to remember that reasonable adjustments in the context of the Equality Act are things which can mitigate a disadvantage suffered by the dyslexic employee. So there has to be a link between the adjustment and the disadvantage itself. So going back to the question, at this point, it is not clear whether the employee has dyslexia, and if so, whether it would amount to a disability. However, the fact that the employee has raised this in the context of performance issues suggests that they are struggling with work tasks, and this could be a potential disadvantage for them. A diagnostic assessment could confirm the position, as well as recommend adjustments that you could make to mitigate the impact of dyslexia on the ongoing performance. But would this be a reasonable adjustment in itself? And the simple answer is that funding the diagnostic assessment on its own is not going to amount to a reasonable adjustment. And this is because, as I've just mentioned, an adjustment needs to remedy a disadvantage. However, an adjustment to the normal performance management procedure by stopping to get a medical opinion or an expert opinion would be potentially a reasonable adjustment. Although funding an assessment might not be a reasonable adjustment, this isn't to say it wouldn't be advisable regardless. In this situation, you would be advised to proceed with caution and, as a minimum, take time within the performance management process to fully explore and investigate whether a medical condition is the cause of this employee's poor performance and whether making any adjustment is reasonable in the circumstances and would make a material difference in assisting them to overcome the difficulties they are facing. And it is difficult to see how this could be done properly without that expert input. If you discuss this with the employee in full, you may arrive at a conclusion that they would fund their own assessment potentially, or they might wait for an NHS intervention. The latter may well take longer time than any other intervention. So funding an assessment privately is likely to save you time, which means that you could progress with the performance management process in a meaningful way, having found out either that the impact is minor or having been given some adjustments that you could look at implementing. In a wider sense, if it is practicable and affordable, it may be sensible to implement adjustments for neurodivergent employees in general, regardless of whether the definition of disability is met, as you are likely to see outcomes such as improved work performance and motivation, and you will generally foster an inclusive work culture and reduce the risk of grievances and complaints being brought to you, and more importantly, the risk of constructive dismissal and discrimination claims in general. To finish off with the first question, if you are looking for additional information, which you can find from public sources regarding dyslexia or neurodiversity in general, you may wish to look at the websites for Dyslexia Action or British Dyslexia Association or the Access to Work, which is on the government.gov.uk website. So that is it for the first question, and I will now pass you to my colleague Angela.
Thank you, Karina, and good morning, everybody. It's always lovely to have the trainees join us on one of these Q&As as well, and I think it takes a lot of bravery, so well done there, Karina. My question is relating to TUPE, which everybody wants to talk about on a Friday morning. So when there's going to be a TUPE transfer, how should we treat employees who are on fixed term contracts which are due to come to an end the day before the transfer? Well, the short answer is, well, it kind of depends. But let's have a look. So if we break it down, the end of a fixed term contract is a dismissal under the Employment Rights Act of 1996. So we've got a dismissed employee who has been terminated the day before a TUPE transfer. Now, A TUPE transfer applies where we've got what we define as a relevant transfer. Now, a relevant transfer broadly means that there has been a transfer of what we call an economic entity, which retains its identity. And we would assess this by looking at a number of factors which are derived from case law, which are dealt with on a case-by-case basis. But let's presume there is a TUPE transfer. We've established the relevant transfer, we need to look at the impact on any employment relationship. So subject to an employee objecting to a transfer, so prior to a transfer, any employee can say, I do not want to transfer to the transferee, who is your buyer of the business, the service provision, etc. Their contract will be terminated, but there'll be no dismissal in law, but that's a separate topic in itself. So subject to the objection, the contracts of employment of those employees who are employed by the transferor, that's your seller, and subject to this relevant transfer, they automatically transfer to the transferee, that is your buyer. And this covers employees who are employed, and the regulations use the term immediately before the transfer. Now you may go, well, immediately before, does that mean the day before? No, it means at the moment of transfer. So the courts have given the term immediately before a very strict and literal interpretation to assign what we call the regulation for protection, that is an automatic transfer principle. So the employee needs to be employed at the moment of transfer. But an employee who would have been employed had they not been dismissed in circumstances where the sole or principal reason for the dismissal is the transfer, may still go across. So what that means is if an employee is dismissed by the transferor, your seller, prior to the transfer, because of the transfer, their employment will still transfer to the transferee, your buyer, under the regulations. And this is known as the Lister principle. Comes from a 1989 or 1987 case back in the old House of Lords. So when we're looking at the expiry of a fixed term contract, what's important to note is, why is it coming to an end? If the fixed term contract is coming to its natural end by virtue of its normal fixed term expiration, there would be no transfer of that contract over to the buyer, the transferee, nor would any liability for that termination transfer to the transferee. But as the transferor, the seller, you may still be liable for an ordinary unfair dismissal claim. If you're terminating the fixed term contract by reasons that are connected to the transfer, then that dismissal will be what we call automatically unfair, i.e. there is no defence to the termination. And the contract and any liability for the termination would transfer to the transferee. Your business transfer agreement would likely have a caveat in there that if there are any circumstances relating to a dismissal immediately before the transfer, that you would be liable for the costs associated with any claim. But again, everything comes down to drafting. So to go back to the question, we have a fixed term contract expiring the day before the transfer, or provided it's come to its natural end, that's absolutely fine, but you might still be liable for an unfair dismissal. If it's related to the transfer, then liability potentially transfers over to your buyer, subject to the terms of your business transfer agreement. Okie dokes, I think I did well there because I saw the window cleaners and my dog is fast asleep, so we've avoided a barking ridge. So thank you very much, and I'll pass you over to my colleague Max.
Good morning everybody, and welcome again to this. The third question we've got here is one not without certain interest, I think, especially as we come up to the traditional Christmas holiday and Christmas party season. So what the question is, an employee's raised a complaint about a colleague, but they don't want to make it formal. So what are the duties? Now, I'll come on to a new duty that will be, I think, something that we'll have to be thinking about in 2024. But just to sort of have a little bit of a recap on this and looking at grievance and discipline in general, First point to bear in mind in that whether you're investigating this for a grievance purpose or a disciplinary purpose, there's an overarching duty to be fair in that particular process. So, for example, take a typical conduct dismissal, an investigation that could potentially lead to a dismissal on the grounds of conduct. Question there is, how far can you use, for example, anonymous complaints? And I suppose the short answer is everything depends on context and the situation. If you look at the helpful ACAS guidance on this sort of topic, they will say, well, the problem with anonymous allegations or even anonymous statements is it doesn't give the accused person enough information to properly defend themselves where their job is at stake. But as I said, important to remember, all about context. Now, let's put this in a slightly more specific situation. Here you've got a situation where somebody is complaining about another employee's behaviour to them. So that could be, unfortunately, one that immediately springs to mind, sexual harassment in the workplace. Now, you'll recall a moment ago, I said that we're going to have to look at some new angles to this particular duty in future. And the reason for that is we've now got a new act. It's got the catchy title of the Worker Protection Brackets Amendment of Equality Act 2010 Act 2023. A bit too many dates in that. But anyway, what that does, it cures one problem that we've had in the Equality Act with regard to third party harassment in the workplace. But it also goes a little bit further and introduces a new duty. And that new duty is a specific duty to prevent sexual harassment in the workplace. So the old Equality Act, as many of you out there will know, once upon a time contained provisions with regard to third party harassment. And those provisions were actually chopped by the coalition government back in about 2013. It was controversial at the time. The government said, oh no, this is just a burden on business, let's scrap it. Unfortunately for the government, pretty soon after they decided to scrap those provisions, we had all sorts of high profile harassment type cases. The one that immediately springs to mind, we got Harvey Weinstein, but there were others as well. And we've been talking about making amendments to the Act ever since. Now, kind of as a matter of logic, one thinks, well, why don't we just reinstate Section 40? Parliamentary time being what it is, that never happened. But a lucky MP, Weir Hobhouse, actually won the ballot to introduce a private members bill. So instead of a kind of more a broader overview of the Equality Act, we had a private members bill that catchily titled Worker Protection Amendment of Equality Act 2010 Act 2023, which is now on the statute books, but its effects won't be made won't be brought into force until October 2024, and that new duty. So getting back to the question, for example, if that complaint, albeit informal, and where you've got a reluctant complainant related to sexual harassment in the workplace, and the employer doesn't do anything about it, that's the sort of background facts that is going to cause no end of problems when we have that new duty to prevent sexual harassment in particular. So you're going to have to think very carefully about the nature of the complaint and what steps you can take. Is it something that you've got to investigate for the sake of other employees? So that would then bring you on to questions like, is this a one-off? Are there other employees out there who have potentially complained? And something I suppose one could throw out more generally to those listening. As part of the Section 1 statement, of course, there will be a grievance policy and a disciplinary policy. Within disciplinary policies, not unusual to see provisions that specifically deal with the question of how you go about complaining, and also those policies that will prescribe certain types of complaint. In other words, those that make frivolous complaints can find themselves at the wrong end of the disciplinary process. Recent case, Hope and the British Medical Association dealt with just that, where you had someone making a series or bringing a series of complaints, but then not kind of pressing them and not withdrawing them. And the employers in that case got fed up with that, having to deal with that, and said, right, enough is enough. We're going to bring disciplinary proceedings against you. Hope was sacked and the dismissal was found to be fair. Now, I think that interesting case, there are always dangers, I think, in this scenario, that you turn the victim kind of into the problem. So you've got to ensure that there's enough openness about the process, that the individual concern doesn't feel that they're in an environment where they can't raise and bring to their employer's attention issues, particularly with regard to aspects like sexual harassment. And don't forget, these things will always have a reputational risk for any organisation. You don't want to be out there branded as an organisation that tolerates inappropriate behaviour in the workplace. So, if kind of just summing up, I'm afraid to say the kind of short answer here to what we're talking about is that this type of issue is very much fact specific. You've got to look at the issues, what sort of things are being alleged. If it's a case of sexual harassment, are there, for example, other complainants? If there are, then you can't just idly sit by and say, no, we're going to let this ride because the employee won't commit him or herself to putting down their complaints in writing. Equally, one has to remember that if you are going through any disciplinary situation, the person accused, at the very least, is going to have to know the details of what they're being accused of in order that they can properly defend themselves against any allegations that are being put to them. So you've got to navigate a difficult path. And of course, that's where taking legal advice will always pay dividends. So, well, I don't have any more on that. So I'm going to hand you back to Dave to conclude matters.
Thanks very much, Max. Thanks very much to all three of you. Really enjoyed listening to that one. There was quite a lot to get through. Very quickly for me, as I say, at the end of each of these sessions, we continue to work hard to produce, release, deliver useful and relevant content, articles, podcasts, blogs, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look at that. There's a whole wealth of employment-related content on the website, from the pages themselves, which are really, really insightful, through to things like this we do, all our bulletins and updates. Obviously, there's this live Q&A at the end of each month, where we have now 51 episodes under our belt and 51 episodes on the website, which is amazing. So lots of information there that is designed just to be useful, helpful, and point you in the right direction. In addition to that, if you haven't heard enough from us at that point, you can also follow the team on socials, and for Twitter, it's at SintonsHR. I've just popped our speakers' details back on the screen there in front of you, should you wish to get in touch with them about anything they've discussed today, or indeed in any of the sessions, the details are there. But I'll just, for people who listen to this on podcast, just very, very quickly, via telephone for all three, 0191226 7878, and via email, angela.carver@sintons.co.uk, max.winthrop@sintons.co.uk, and karina.dias@sintons.co.uk. That is all from us today. We were just talking just before we went live. We've got a record number of people watching this morning, so thank you so much for that. I'll tell Karina quite how many there is after we've We've come off the air, but thank you. We don't take this for granted. This little session that we started back in COVID times has just grown and grown and grown, and it's one of the stalwarts of our communications per month. So thank you for that. We genuinely do appreciate it. We will see you for the final one in December. There was something said earlier about it being done in Christmas jumpers. I absolutely refuse to do that, so I won't be. So I'll be back dressed as me. The guys will no doubt be in Christmas jumpers, and we'll speak to you then. Stay safe, everyone. Enjoy December, and we'll speak to you then. Thank you.